Welcome to Jaded YA Reads, a YA read aloud podcast for teens, tweens, and adults, brought to you by the Wells Public Library. This season, we'll be reading The Hobbit by J.R.R. Tolkien. Chapter 13. In the meanwhile, the dwarves sat in darkness and utter silence fell about them. Little they ate and little they spoke. They could not count the passing of time, and they scarcely dared to move, for the whisper of their voices echoed and rustled in the tunnel. If they dozed, they woke still to darkness and to silence going on unbroken. At last, after days and days of waiting, as it seemed, when they were becoming choked and dazed for want of air, they could bear it no longer. They would almost have welcome sounds from below of the dragon's return. In the silence, they feared some cunning devilry of his, but they could not sit there forever. Thorin spoke. "Let us try the door," he said. "I must feel the wind on my face soon or die. I think I would rather be smashed by Smaug in the open than suffocate in here." So several of the dwarves got up and groped back to where the door had been, but they found that the upper end of the tunnel had been shattered and blocked with broken rock. Neither key nor magic it had once obeyed would ever open that door again. "We are trapped," they groaned. "This is the end. We shall die here." But somehow, just when the dwarves were at their most despairing, Bilbo felt a strange lightening of the heart, as if a heavy weight had gone from under his waistcoat. "Come, come," he said. "While there's life, there's hope, as my father used to say, and third time pays for all. I am going down the tunnel once again. I have been that way twice, where I knew there was a dragon at the other end, so I will risk a third visit when I am no longer sure. Anyway, the only other way out is down, and I think this time you had better all come with me." In desperation, they agreed, and Thorin was the first to go forward by Bilbo's side. "Now do be careful," whispered the hobbit, "and as quiet as you can be. There may be no Smaug at the bottom, but then again there might be. Don't let us take any unnecessary risks." Down, down they went. The dwarves could not, of course, compare with the hobbit in real stealth, and they made a deal of puffing and shuffling which echoes magnified alarmingly. But though every now and again Bilbo in fear stopped and listened, not a sound stirred below. Near the bottom, as well as he could judge, Bilbo slipped on his ring and went ahead. But he did not need it, the darkness was complete, and they were all invisible, ring or no ring. In fact, so black was it that the hobbit came to the opening unexpectedly, put his hand on air, stumbled forward, and rolled headlong into the hall. There he lay, face downwards on the floor, and did not dare to get up, or hardly even to breathe. But nothing moved. There was not a gleam of light, unless, as it seemed to him, when at last they slowly raised their head, there was a pale white glint above him and far off in the gloom. But certainly it was not a spark of dragon fire, though the warm stench was heavy in the place, and the taste of vapor was on his tongue. At length, Mr. Baggins could bear it no longer. "Confound you, Smaug, you worm," he squeaked aloud. "Stop playing hide-and-seek. Give me a light, and then eat me, if you can catch me." Faint echoes ran round the unseen hall, but there was no answer. Bilbo got up and found that he did not know in what direction to turn. "Now I wonder what on earth Smaug is playing at," he said. "He is not at home today, or tonight, or whatever it is, I do believe. If Owen and Glowin had not lost their tinderboxes, perhaps we could make a little light and have a look round before the luck turns." "Light," he cried. "Can anybody make a light?" The dwarves, of course, were very alarmed when Bilbo fell forward down the step with a bump into the hall, and they sat huddled just where he had left them at the end of the tunnel. "Shh," they hissed, when they found his voice. And though it helped the hobbit to find out where they were, it was some time before he could actually get anything else out of them. But in the end, when Bilbo actually began to stamp on the floor and screamed out, "Light!" at the top of his shrill voice, Thorin gave way, and Owen and Glowin were sent back to their bundles at the top of the tunnel. After a while, a twinkling gleam showed them returning, Owen with a small pine torch alight in his hand, and Glowin with a bundle of others under his arm. Quickly, Bilbo trotted to the door and took the torch, but he could not persuade the dwarves to light the others or to come and join him yet. As Thorin carefully explained, Mr. Baggins was still officially their expert burglar and investigator. If he liked to risk a light, that was his affair. They would wait in the tunnel for his report. So they sat near the door and watched. They saw the little dark shape of the hobbit start across the floor, holding his tiny light aloft. Every now and again, while he was still near enough, they caught a glint and a tinkle as he stumbled onto some golden thing. The light grew smaller as he wandered away into the vast hall, then it began to rise dancing into the air. Bilbo was climbing the great mound of treasure. Soon he stood upon the top and still went on. Then they saw him halt and stoop for a moment, but they did not know the reason. It was the Arkenstone, the heart of the mountain. So Bilbo guessed from Thorin's description, but indeed there could not be two such gems, even in so marvelous a hoard, even in all the world. Ever as he climbed, the same white gleam had shone before him and drawn his feet towards it. Slowly it grew to a little globe of pallid light. Now as he came near, it was tinged with a flickering sparkle of many colors at the surface, reflected and splintered from the wavering light of his torch. At last he looked down upon it, and he caught his breath. The great jewel shone before his feet of its own inner light, and yet, cut and fashioned by the dwarves, who had dug it from the heart of the mountain long ago, it took all light that fell upon it and changed it into 10,000 sparks of white radiance shot with glints of the rainbow. Suddenly, Bilbo's arm went towards it, drawn by its enchantment. His small hand would not close about it, for it was large and a heavy gem, but he lifted it, shut his eyes, and put it in his deepest pocket. "Now I am a burglar indeed," thought he, "but I suppose I must tell the dwarves about it, sometime. They did say I could pick and choose my own share, and I think I would choose this if they took all the rest." All the same, he had an uncomfortable feeling that the picking and choosing had not really meant he was to include this marvelous gem, and that trouble would yet come of it. Now he went on again. Down the other side of the great mound he climbed, and the spark of his torch vanished from the sight of the watching dwarves. But soon they saw it far away in the distance again. Bilbo was crossing the floor of the hall. He went on until he came to a great door at the further side, and there a draught of air refreshed him, but it almost puffed out his light. He peeped timidly through and caught a glimpse of great passages and of the dim beginnings of wide stairs going up into the gloom. And still there was no sight nor sound of Smaug. He was just going to turn and go back when a black shape swooped at him and brushed his face. He squeaked and started, stumbled backwards and fell. His torch dropped head downwards and went out. "Only a bat, I suppose, and hope," he said miserably. "But now what am I to do? Which is east, south, north, or west? Thorin, Balin, Owen, Glowin, Feely, Keely," he cried as loud as he could. It seemed a thin little noise in the wide blackness. "The light's gone out. Someone come and find me and help me." For the moment, his courage had failed altogether. Faintly, the dwarves heard his small cries, though the only word they could catch was "help." "Now what on earth or under it has happened?" said Thorin. "Certainly not the dragon, or he would not go on squeaking." They waited a moment or two, and still there was no dragon noises, no sound at all, in fact, but Bilbo's distant voice. "Come on, one of you, get another light or two," Thorin ordered. "It seems we have got to go and help our burglar." "It is about our turn to help," said Balin, "and I am quite willing to go. Anyway, I expect it is safe at the moment." Glowin lit several more torches, and then they all crept out, one by one, and went along the wall as hurriedly as they could. It was not long before they met Bilbo himself coming back towards them. His wits had quickly returned as soon as he saw the twinkle of their lights. "Only a bat and a dropped torch, nothing worse," he said in answer to their questions. Though they were much relieved, they were inclined to be grumpy at being frightened for nothing. But what they would have said, if he had told them at the moment about the Arkenstone, I don't know. The mere fleeting glimpses of treasure, which they had caught as they went along, had rekindled all the fire of their dwarvish hearts. And when the heart of a dwarf, even the most respectable, is wakened by gold and by jewels, he grows suddenly bold, and he may become fierce. The dwarves, indeed, no longer needed any urging. All were now eager to explore the hall while they had the chance, and willing to believe that, for the present, Smaug was away from home. Each now gripped a lighted torch, and as they gazed, first on one side and then on another, they forgot fear and even caution. They spoke aloud and cried out to one another as they lifted old treasures from the mound or from the wall and held them in the light, caressing and fingering them. Feely and Keely were almost in merry mood, and finding still hanging there were many golden harps strung with silver, they took them and struck them, and being magical, and also untouched by the dragon, who had small interest in music, they were still in tune. The dark hall was filled with a melody that had long been silent, but most of the dwarves were more practical. They gathered gems and stuffed their pockets, and let what they could not carry back through their fingers with a sigh. Thorin was not least among these, but always he searched from side to side for something which he could not find. It was the Arkenstone, but he spoke of it yet to no one. Now the dwarfs took down mail and weapons from the walls and armed themselves. Royal indeed did Thorin look, clad in a coat of gold-plated rings, with a silver-hafted axe and a belt crested with scarlet stones. "Mr. Baggins," he cried, "here is the first payment of your reward. Cast off your old coat and put on this." With that he put on Bilbo a small coat of mail, wrought for some young elf prince long ago. It was of silver steel, which the elves called mithril, and with it went a belt of pearls and crystals. A light helm of figured leather, strengthened beneath with hoops of steel, and studded about the brim with white gems, was set upon the hobbit's head. "I feel magnificent," he thought, "but I expect I look rather absurd. How they would laugh on the hill at home. Still, I wish there was a looking-glass handy." All the same, Mr. Baggins kept his head more clear of the bewitchment of the hoard than the dwarves did. Long before the dwarves were tired of examining the treasures, he became weary of it and sat down on the floor, and he began to wonder nervously what the end of all of it would be. "I would give a good many of these precious goblets," he thought, "for a drink of something cheering out of one of Beorn's wooden bowls." "Thorin," he cried aloud, "what next? We are armed, but what good has any armor ever been against Smaug the Dreadful? This treasure is not yet won back. We are not looking for gold yet, but for a way of escape, and we have tempted luck too long."
"You speak the truth," answered Thorin, recovering his wits. "Let us go. I will guide you. Not in 1,000 years should I forget the ways of this palace." Then he hailed the others, and they gathered together, and holding their torches above their heads, they passed through the gaping doors, not without many a backwards glance of longing. Their glittering mail they had covered again with their old cloaks, and their bright helms with their tattered hoods, and one by one they walked behind Thorin, a line of little lights in the darkness that halted often, listening in fear once more for any rumor of the dragon's coming. Though all of the old adornments were long moldered or destroyed, and though all was befouled and blasted with the comings and goings of the monster, Thorin knew every passage and every turn. They climbed long stairs, and turned and went down wide echoing ways, and turned again and climbed yet more stairs, and yet more stairs again. These were smooth, cut out of the living rock, broad and fair, and up, up, the dwarves went, and they met no sign of any living thing, only furtive shadows that fled from the approach of the torches fluttering in the draughts. The steps were not made all the same for hobbit legs, and Bilbo was just feeling that he could go on no longer, when suddenly the roof sprang high and far beyond the reach of their torchlight. A white glimmer could be seen coming through some opening far above, and the air smelt sweeter. Before them, light came dimly through great doors that hung twisted on their hinges and half burnt. "This is the great chamber of Thor," said Thorin, "the hall of feasting and of council. Not far off now is the front gate." They passed through the ruined chamber. Tables were rotted there. Chairs and benches were lying there overturned, charred, and decaying. Skulls and bones were upon the floor among flagons and bowls and broken drinking horns and dust. As they came through yet more doors at the further end, a sound of water fell upon their ears, and the gray light grew suddenly more full. "There is the birth of the running river," said Thorin. "From here it hastens to the gate. Let us follow it." Out of a dark opening in a wall of rock there issued a boiling water, and it flowed swirling into a narrow channel, carved and made straight and deep by the cunning of ancient hands. Beside it ran a stone-paved road, wide enough for many men abreast. Swiftly along this they ran, and round a wide sweeping turn, and behold, before them stood the broad light of day. In front there rose a tall arch, still showing the fragments of old carven work within, worn and splintered and blackened though it was. A misty sun set its pale light between the arms of the mountain, and beams of gold fell on the pavement at the threshold. A whirl of bats, frightened from slumber by their smoking torches, flurried over them. As they sprang forward, their feet slithered on stones rubbed smooth and slimed by the passing of the dragon. Now before them, the water fell noisily outward and foamed down towards the valley. They flung their pale torches to the ground and stood gazing out with dazzled eyes. They were come to the front gate and were looking out upon Dale.
"Well," said Bilbo, "I never expected to be looking out this door, and I never expected to be so pleased to see the sun again and to feel the wind on my face. But, ow, this wind is cold."
It was. A bitter easterly breeze blew with the threat of oncoming winter. It swirled over and round the arms of the mountain into the valley, and sighed among the rocks. After their long time in the stewing depths of the dragon-haunted caverns, they shivered in the sun. Suddenly, Bilbo realized that he was not only tired, but also very hungry indeed. "It seems to be late morning," he said, "and so I suppose it is more or less breakfast time, if there is any breakfast to have. But I don't feel that Smaug's front doorstep is the safest place for a meal. Do let's go somewhere where we can sit quiet for a bit."
"Quite right," said Balin, "and I think I know which way
we should go. We ought to make for the old lookout post at the southwest corner of the mountain."
"How far is that?" asked the hobbit.
5 hours' march, I should think. It'll be a rough going. The road from the gate along the left edge of the stream seems all broken up. But look down there. The river loops suddenly east across Dale in front of a ruined town. At that point there was once a bridge, leading to steep stairs that climbed up the right bank, and so to a road running towards Ravenhill. There is, or was, a path that left the road and climbed up to the post. A hard climb, too, even if the old steps are still there.
"Dear me," grumbled the hobbit. "More walking and more climbing without breakfast? I wonder how many breakfasts and other meals we have missed inside that nasty, clockless, timeless hole."
As a matter of fact, 2 nights and the day between had gone by, and not altogether without food, since the dragon smashed the magic door, but Bilbo had quite lost count, and it might have been 1 night or a week of nights for all he could tell.
"Come, come," said Thorin, laughing. His spirits had begun to rise again, and he rattled the precious stones in his pockets. "Don't call my palace a nasty hole. You wait till it had been cleaned and redecorated."
"That won't be till Smaug's dead," said Bilbo glumly. "In the meanwhile, where is he? I would give a good breakfast to know. I hope he is not up on the mountain looking down at us." That idea disturbed the dwarves mightily, and they quickly decided that Bilbo and Balin were right. "We must move away from here," said Dory. "I feel as if his eyes were on the back of my head."
"It's a cold, lonesome place," said Bomber. "There may be a drink, but I see no sign of food. A dragon would always be hungry in such parts."
"Come on, come on," cried the others. "Let us follow Balin's path." Under the rocky wall to the right, there was no path, so on they trudged among the stones on the left side of the river, and the emptiness and desolation soon sobered even Thorin again. The bridge that Balin had spoken of they found long fallen, and most of its stones were now only boulders in the shallow, noisy stream. But they forded the water without much difficulty, and found the ancient steps, and climbed the high bank. After going a short way, they struck the old road, and before long came to a deep dell sheltered among the rocks. There they rested for a while, and had such a breakfast as they could, chiefly cram and water. If you want to know what cram is, I can only say that I don't know the recipe, but it is biscuitish, keeps good indefinitely, and is supposed to be sustaining, and is certainly not entertaining, being in fact very uninteresting, except as a chewing exercise. It was made by the lake men for long journeys. After that, they went on again, and now the road struck westwards and left the river, and the great shoulder of the south-pointing mountain spur drew ever nearer. At length, they reached the hill path. It scrambled steeply up, and they plodded slowly one behind the other, till at last in the late afternoon they came to the top of the ridge and saw the wintry sun going downwards to the west. Here they found a flat place without a wall on 3 sides, but back to the north by a rocky face in which there was an opening like a door. From that door there was a wide view east and south and west. "Here," said Balin, "in the old days we used to always keep watchmen, and that door behind leads into a rock-hewn chamber that was made here as a guard room. But there are several places like it round the mountain. There seemed to be small need for watching in the days of our prosperity, and the guards were made over comfortable, perhaps. Otherwise, we might have had longer warning of the coming of the dragon, and things might have been different.
Still, here we can now lie hid and sheltered for a while, and you can see much without being seen."
"Not much use if we have been seen coming here," said Dori, who was always looking up the mountain's peak, as if he expected to see Smaug perched there like a bird on a steeple.
"We must take our chance of that," said Thorin. "We can go no further today."
"Hear, hear," cried Bilbo, and flung himself on the ground. In the rock chamber, there would have been room for 100, and there was a small chamber further in, more removed from the cold outside. It was quite deserted. Not even wild animals seemed to have used it in all the days of Smaug's dominion. There they laid their burdens, and some threw themselves down at once and slept, but the others sat near the outer door and discussed their plans. In all their talk, they came perpetually back to one thing. Where was Smaug? They looked west, and there was nothing. In east, there was nothing. And in the south, there was no sign of the dragon. But there was a gathering of very many birds. And that they gazed and wondered. But they were no nearer understanding it when the first cold stars came out.
Chapter 14.
Now if you wish, like the dwarves, to hear news of Smaug, you must go back to the evening when he smashed the door and flew off in a rage 2 days before. The men of the lake town Escaroth were mostly indoors, for the breeze was from the black east and chill, but a few were walking on the quays and watching, as they were fond of doing, the stars shine out from the smooth patches of the lake as they open in the sky. From their town, the lonely mountain was mostly screened by the low hills at the far end of the lake, through a gap in which the running river came down from the north. Only its high peak could they see in the clear weather, and they looked seldom at it, for it was ominous and drear even in the light of the morning. Now it was lost and gone, blotted in the dark. Suddenly it flickered back to view, a brief glow touched it and faded. "Look," said one, "the lights again. Last night the watchmen saw them start and fade from midnight until dawn. Something is happening up there."
"Perhaps the king under the mountain is forging gold," said another.
"It is long since he went north, but it's time the songs began to prove themselves again."
"Which king?" said another with a grim voice.
"As like as not is the moddering fire of the dragon, the only king under the mountain we have ever known."
"You are always foreboding gloomy things," said the others. "Anything from floods to poisoned fish. Think of something cheerful."
Then suddenly a great light appeared in the low place in the hills, and the northern end of the lake turned golden.
"The king beneath the mountain," they shouted. "His wealth is like the sun, his silver like a fountain, his river is golden run. The river is running gold from the mountain," they cried, and everywhere windows were opening and feet were hurrying. There was once more tremendous excitement and enthusiasm,
but the grim-voiced fellow ran hotfoot to the master.
"The dragon is coming, or I am a fool," he cried. "Cut the bridges! To arms! To arms!"
Then warning trumpets were suddenly sounded and echoed along the rocky shores. The cheering stopped, and the joy was turned to dread. So it was that the dragon did not find them quite unprepared. Before long, so great was his speed, they could see him as a spark of fire rushing towards them and growing ever huger and more bright, and not the most foolish doubted that the prophecies had gone rather wrong. Still, they had a little time. Every vessel in town was filled with water, every warrior was armed, every arrow and dart was ready, and the bridge to the land was thrown down and destroyed before the roar of Smaug's terrible approach grew loud, and the lake rippled red as fire beneath the awful beating of his wings. Amid shrieks and wailing and the shouts of men, he came over them, swept towards the bridges, and was foiled. The bridge was gone, and his enemies were on an island in deep water, too deep and dark and cool for his liking. If he plunged into it, a vapor and a steam would arise enough to cover all the land with a mist for days, but the lake was mightier than he, and it would quench him before he could pass through. Roaring, he swept back over the town. A hail of dark arrows leaped up and snapped and rattled on his scales and jewels, and their shafts fell back, kindled by his breath, burning and hissing into the lake. No fireworks you ever imagined equaled the sights that night. At the twanging of the bows and the shrilling of the trumpets, the dragon's wrath blazed to its height, till he was blind and mad with it. No one had dared to give battle to him for many an age, nor would they have dared, if it had not been for the grim-voiced man, Bard was his name, who ran to and fro cheering on the archers and urging the master to order them to fight to the last arrow. Fire leaped from the dragon's jaws. He circled for a while, high in the air above them, lighting all the lake. The trees by the shores shone like copper and like blood, with leaping shadows of dense black at their feet. Then down he swooped straight through the arrow storm, reckless in his rage, taking no heed to turn his scaly side towards his foes, seeking only to set their town ablaze. Fire leaped from thatched roofs and wooden beam ends as he hurtled down and passed them round again, though all had been drenched with water before he came. Once more water was flung by 100 hands wherever a spark appeared. Back swirled the dragon, a sweep of his tail and the roof of the great house crumbled and smashed down. Flames unquenchable sprang high into the night. Another swoop in another and another house, and then another sprang afire and fell, and still no arrow hindered Smaug or hurt him more than a fly from the marshes. Already men were jumping into the water on every side. Women and children were being huddled into laden boats in the market pool. Weapons were flung down. There was mourning and weeping, where but a little time ago the old songs of mirth to come had been sung about the dwarves. Now men cursed their names. The master himself was turning to his great gilded boat, hoping to row away in the confusion and save himself. Soon all the town would be deserted and burned down to the surface of the lake. That was the dragon's hope. They could all get into boats for all he cared. There he could have fine sport hunting them, or they could stop till they starved. Let them try to get to land, and he would be ready. Soon he would set. The great bow twanged. A black arrow sped straight from the string, straight for the hollow by the left breast where the foreleg was flung wide. In it smote and vanished barb, shaft, and feather, so fierce was its flight. With a shriek that deafened men, felled trees, and split stone, Smaug shot spouting into the air, turned over, and crashed down from on high in ruin. Full on the town he fell. His last throw splintered it to sparks and gleeds. The lake roared in, a vast steam leapt up, white in the sudden dark under the moon. There was a hiss, a gushing whirl, and then silence. And that was the end of Smaug and Escaroth, but not of Bard. All the shoreland woods ablaze, and wither every field and pasture. Just now he was enjoying the sport of town baiting more than he had enjoyed for anything for years. But there was still a company of archers that held their ground among the burning houses. Their captain was Bard, grim-voiced and grim-faced, whose friends had accused him of prophesying floods and poisoned fish, though they knew his worth and courage. He was a descendant in long line of Geryon, Lord of Dale, whose wife and child had escaped down the running river from the ruin long ago. Now he shot with a great yew bow, till all his arrows but one were spent. The flames were near him. His companions were leaving him. He bent his bow for the last time. Suddenly, out of the dark, something fluttered to his shoulder. He started, but it was only an old thrush. Unafraid, it perched by his ear and brought him news. Marveling, he found he could understand its tongue, for he was of the race of Dale. "Wait, wait," it said to him. "The moon is rising. Look for the hollow of the left breast as he flies and turns above you." And while Bard paused in wonder, it told him of tidings up in the mountain, and all that it had heard. Then Bard drew his bowstring to his ear. The dragon was circling back, flying low, and as he came, the moon rose above the eastern shore and silvered his great wings. "Arrow," said the bowman, "black arrow, I have saved you to the last. You have never failed me, and always I have recovered you. I had you from my father, and he from of old. If ever you came from the forges of the true king under the mountain, go now and speed well." The dragon swooped once more lower than ever, and as he turned and dived down, his belly glittered white with sparkling fires of gems in the moon, but not in one place. The waxing moon rose higher and higher, and the wind grew loud and cold. It twisted the white fog into bending pillars and hurrying clouds, and drove it off to the west to scatter in tattered shreds over the marshes before Mirkwood. Then the many boats could be seen dotted dark on the surface of the lake, and down the wind came the voices of the people of Escaroth lamenting their lost town and goods and ruined houses. But they had really much to be thankful for, had they thought of it, though it could hardly be expected that they should just then. 3/4 of the people of the town had at least escaped alive. Their woods and fields and pastures and cattle and most of their boats remained undamaged, and the dragon was dead. What that meant, they had not yet realized. They gathered in mournful crowds upon the western shores, shivering in the cold wind, and their first complaints and anger were against the master, who had left the town so soon, while some were still willing to defend it. "He may have a good head for business, especially his own business," some muttered, "but he is no good when anything serious happens." And they praised the courage of Bard in his last mighty shot. "If only he had not been killed," they all said, we would make him a king. Bard the dragon shooter of the line of Geryon, alas that he is lost. And in the very midst of their talk, a tall figure stepped from the shadows. He was drenched with water, his black hair hung wet over his face and shoulders, and a fierce light was in his eyes.
"Bard is not lost," he cried. "He dived from Escaroth, where the enemy was slain. I am Bard, of the line of Geryon. I am the slayer of the dragon." "King Bard! King Bard!" they shouted, but the master ground his chattering teeth. "Geryon was Lord of Dale, not King of Escaroth," he said. "In the Lake Town, we have always elected masters from among the old and wise, and have not endured the rule of mere fighting men. Let King Bard go back to his own kingdom. Dale is now freed by his valor, and nothing hinders his return. And any that wish can go with him, if they prefer the cold stones under the shadow of the mountain to the green shores of the lake. The wise will stay here and hope to rebuild our town, and enjoy again in time its peace and riches."
"We will have King Bard," the people near at hand shouted in reply. "We have had enough of the old men and the money counters." And people further off took up the cry, "Up the bowmen and down the money bags," till the clamor echoed along the shore. "I am the last man to undervalue Bard the bowman," said the master warily, for Bard now stood close beside him. "He has tonight earned an eminent place in the roll of the benefactors of our town, and he is worthy of many imperishable songs. But why, O people," and here the master rose to his feet and spoke very loud and clear, "why do I get all your blame? For what fault am I to be deposed? Who aroused the dragon from his slumber, I might ask? Who obtained of us rich gifts and ample help, and led us to believe that old songs would come true? Who played on our soft hearts and our pleasant fancies? What sort of gold have they sent down the river to reward us? Dragon fire and ruin. From whom should we claim the recompense of our damage and aid for our widows and orphans?" As you see, the master had not got his position for nothing. The result of his words was that for the moment the people quite forgot their idea of a new king, and turned their angry thoughts towards Thorin and his company. Wild and bitter words were shouted from many sides, and some of those who had before sung the old songs loudest were now heard as loudly crying that the dwarves had stirred the dragon up against them deliberately. "Fools," said Bard, "why waste words and wrath on those unhappy creatures? Doubtless they perished first in fire before Smaug came to us." Then even as he was speaking, the thought came to him into his heart of the fabled treasure of the mountain, lying without guard or owner, and he fell suddenly silent. He thought of the master's words, and of Dale rebuilt, and filled with golden bells, if he could but find the men. At last he spoke again. "There is no time for angry words, master, or for considering weighty plans of change. There is work to do. I serve you still, though after a while I may think again of your words and go north with any that will follow me." Then he strode off to help in the ordering of the camps and the care of the sick of the wounded. But the master scowled at his back as he went, and remained sitting on the ground. He thought much, but said little, unless it was to call loudly for men to bring him fire and food. Now everywhere Bard went, he found talk running like fire among the people concerning the vast treasure that was now unguarded. Men spoke of the recompense for all their harm that they would soon get from it, and wealth over and to spare, with which to buy great things from the south, and it cheered them greatly in their plight. That was as well, for the night was bitter and miserable. Shelters could be contrived for few, the master had one, and there was little food. Even the master went short. Many took ill of wet and cold and sorrow that night, and afterwards died, who had escaped uninjured from the ruin of the town, and in the days that followed there was much sickness and great hunger. Meanwhile, Bard took the lead and ordered things as he wished, though always in the master's name, and he had a hard task to govern the people and direct the preparations for their protection and housing. Probably most of them would have perished in the winter that now hurried after autumn if help had not been to hand. But help came swiftly, for Bard at once had speedy messengers sent up the river to the forest to ask the aid of the King of the Elves of the Wood,
and these messengers had found a host already on the move, although it was then only the third day after the fall of Smaug. The Elven King had received news from his own messengers, and from the birds that loved his folk, and already knew much of what had happened. Very great indeed was the commotion among all things with wings that dwelt on the borders of the desolation of the dragon. The air was filled with circling flocks, and their swift flying messengers flew here and there across the sky. Above the borders of the forest there was whistling, crying, and piping. Far over Mirkwood tidings spread. Smaug is dead! Leaves rustled and started, ears were lifted. Even before the Elven King rode forth, the news had passed west, right to the pinewoods of the Misty Mountains. Beorn had heard it in his wooden house, and the goblins were at council in their caves. "That will be the last we shall hear of Thorn Oakenshield, I fear," said the king. "He would have done better to have remained my guest. It is an ill wind, all the same," he added, that blows no one any good. For he, too, had not forgotten the legend of the wealth of Thror. So it was that Bard's messengers found him now marching with many spearmen and bowmen, and crows were gathered thick above him, for they thought that war was awakening again, such as had not been in those parts for a long age. But the king, when he received the prayers of Bard, had pity, for he was the lord of a good and kindly people, so turning his march, which had at first been direct towards the mountain, he hastened now down to the river to the long lake. He had not boats or rafts enough for his host, and they were forced to go the slower way by foot. But great store of goods he sent ahead by water. Still, elves are light-footed, and though they were not in those days much used to the marches and the treacherous lands between the forest and the lake, their going was swift. Only 5 days after the death of the dragon they came upon the shores, and looked on the ruins of the town. Their welcome was good, as may be expected, and the men and their master were ready to make any bargain for their future in return for the Elven King's aid. Their plans were soon made. With the women and the children, the old and the unfit, the master remained behind, and with him were some men of crafts and many skilled elves, and they busied themselves felling trees and collecting the timber sent down from the forest. Then they set about raising many huts by the shore against the oncoming winter, and also under the master's direction they began the planning of a new town, designed more fair and large even than before, but not in the same place. They removed northward higher up the shore, for ever after they had a dread of the water where the dragon lay. He would never again return to his golden bed, but was stretched cold as stone, twisted upon the floor of the shallows. There for ages his huge bones could be seen in calm weather, amid the ruined piles of the old town. But few dared to cross the cursed spot, and none dared to dive into the shivering water, or recover their precious stones that fell from his rotting carcass. But all the men of arms who were still able, and the most of Elven King's array, got ready to march north to the mountain. It was thus that in 11 days from the ruin of the town, the head of their host passed the rock gates at the end of the lake and came into the desolate lands.